From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Guerlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Today on the program, I'll speak with Georgia Tech political scientist Jared Hayes about how common identities influence international politics.
If Barack Obama wanted to claim that Canada is an existential threat to the United States, it's unlikely to succeed, regardless of how Obama sees Stephen Harper, who is not on the same wavelength as the president.
But first, Rebecca Cruz and I discuss this week's bombing in Thailand and Thursday's announcement by Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras that he's resigning and calling snap elections.
Of course, we hear the word resign, and that means something else to us here in a presidential system. But this is just him taking a strategic measure.
These conversations are coming up right after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlot. Rebecca Cruz, unrest in Thailand again, but big bombing this week, probably the biggest incident they've had, a violent incident they've had of this sort. But a bombing at a Hindu shrine in Bangkok, Thailand this week killed 20 people. They suspect there are probably about 10 people involved in this, but they don't expect foreign involvement. But they don't really know, I don't think, who did it domestically either, although we've seen a pattern of unrest in Thailand for some time. So that's not terribly surprising. But this kind of event and not really being able to learn much about what's going on yet, definitely somewhat surprising. What do we make of that?
What's hard to know, as you say, what's going on here, but there are a couple of things that are important to know. The unrest actually comes in two directions. We have a situation in southern Thailand where you have an ethnic minority group, the Malays. They happen to be Muslim, but this is really more of a separatist situation where they're trying to have their own country, and we have seen them step up their activities, really kind of get going since 2004. They have done some attacks, yet they have not claimed responsibility for this one, and it really doesn't fit their past MO. But those situations have existed. There's also been another situation, which we talked about last year, when there was a military coup, I believe last May, and a new military government came into power. This is actually the 11th coup that the country has had since the 1930s. Six of them have been successful, a number of others obviously not successful. But this military group that's been in power for the last year is just about to rewrite their constitution and try to get that passed and to get some legitimacy. So perhaps there's a situation here as well. And that's really been a class struggle between the urban elitists and then the farmers out in the rural communities. So lots of unrest going on. We're going to have to wait and see what the motivation is and see if anyone claims responsibility.
Well, of course, this is a shrine that's visited by many foreigners. And in fact, most of the people that died in this attack this week were foreigners. So they aren't necessarily attacking any one particular group, but clearly trying to destabilize the country. And that does seem to continue and seems to be working.
Absolutely. There was some thought that this might have been directed towards China, but officials are coming out and saying that, no, that's not the case. They really don't know enough information yet at this time, though.
So let's shift to Greece and more breaking news. Recent resignation by the Greek prime minister only 6 months after he was actually elected or placed into that position. But this isn't what it seems. He's resigning and calling for special elections next month because he needs to have special elections, apparently, in order to kind of shore up some confidence in him. There was the whole bailout plan. We know what's been going on with Greece for some time, the economic instability, the significant economic crisis there. And there's a deep split in the kind of the coalition that he's trying to bring back together. So, but this is an extreme measure, right, to resign in order to have special elections. But I think everybody thinks he's going to be back in power here pretty soon.
Yeah, I don't think there's any concern for him not coming back into power. And really, with the Greek politics these days, I'm not sure that anything is really all that shocking. But as you said, he's been in power for about 6 months. The split in his party, what was expected was that he was going to call for a vote of confidence within the party, which is something that occurs in parliamentary systems. Of course, we hear the word resign, and that means something else to us here in a presidential system. But this is just him taking a strategic measure. So he's going to skip the party vote of confidence and go directly to the people. He represents this party, Syriza, and is very, very popular. And so going directly to the people is a very strategic move. And he's going to call for very quick elections, probably in the middle of September. And we'll see. But he's likely to reform the coalition, hopefully strengthen the party from his point of view, and get a real strong vote of confidence from the population.
Well, so interesting politics going on. But what is, I mean, ultimately, this has to do with the Greek economy, right? So the economic situation there is still very precarious, with the bailout plan still being rolled out. I mean, there was a lot of question about whether Greece would even be bailed out by the European Union. There's still some question about whether Greece should stay or will stay in the euro or in the European Union. I think most of us are not skeptical about that. We think they'll stay. But nonetheless, this just adds to the whole mixture and intrigue, I guess, on the Greek side of things.
Absolutely. And his timing is significant. He's having this election in September, which means that the initial effects of the bailout, we're not going to see those quite yet. And some think that that is also strategic, whereas he could have waited a little bit longer, but he's going to do it early on.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Rebecca, for being here as always.
Thank you.
If you'd like to share your thoughts about this conversation, you can leave a comment on the Worldviews page of KGOU.org or contact us via Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU. After a break, I'll speak with Jared Hayes, who studies the social science of international diplomacy at Georgia Tech University. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and you're listening to Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. My guest today is Georgia Tech political scientist Jared Hayes, who studies the social dynamics of international relations and security issues. He also researches environmental security, nuclear weapons proliferation, and international rivalries. This interview was also sort of a homecoming for him, since he served as an assistant professor of international relations at the University of Oklahoma in 2009 and 2010. Jared Hayes, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much for having me.
So really interesting work you've always done on issues of identity and security, and a recent book you've published on constructing national security. And I want to start with what you refer to as identity issues and how that influences our international relations. So from what I gather, we're talking about using notions of identity, personal identity, and kind of extrapolating that to the international level, but a sense of how we feel about one another, how we understand ourselves, how we understand others, and how that affects our relationships. Is this what you're talking about? And how can that sense of identity influence what we do at the international level?
So what we see in social psychology is that humans are fundamentally social creatures, right? We think about ourselves in social terms. It's how we make sense of our place in the world. It's how we make sense of ourselves, right? We're constantly positioning ourselves in the context of whatever social group. These identities, then, this sense of we-ness, changes how we understand the world, right? So in a sense, we can think about identities as systems of shared meaning or shared systems of meaning that we use to interpret the world, because the world is very chaotic, very messy. And another finding from neuroscience is that our cognitive abilities are actually much more limited than we like to think. Academics, we like to think that we think everything through, but humans are not capable of doing that, right? So we rely on a range of heuristics, a range of shortcuts to make our worlds intelligible, and identity is one of these really important ways that we do so. So when we meet somebody on the street, we automatically begin to assess who they are in relation to us in this social context. And that is, those are all questions of identity. What social psychologists have found is that depending on which identities are activated, our interpretation of the world changes. and our interests, our ideas align with those of our identity group, the activated identity group. So it's very, very important for understanding how humans interact with the broader world. There are sort of cognitive elements of this, but there are also strong emotional elements of this. So there, social psychologists have found in intergroup emotion theory that actually not just our thinking about the world tends towards the group median, but also our emotional responses to the world tend towards the group. So for example, if you're French American and your American identity is activated, then the period around the Gulf War is one in which you feel you share the American anger towards the French for their refusal to support the United States at the Security Council. But if this individual's French identity is activated, then they share the French sense of resentment or imposition by the Americans, or perhaps a sense of shared French pride at resisting the Americans. The only difference, the same individual, the only difference is which identity is active and that and the emotional response that attends to that. So there are, it's very substantial the ways in which identity shapes our interactions with the world.
So as we go out to interact, so let's say states and governments, you've talked about how humans are social creatures, but states and governments are made up of humans,
sure.
Right? Humans that are making decisions on behalf of their governments and their nations and states. As they're interacting with one another, these same types of levels of feeling and sense of belonging and you're my friend or you're not, you know, those kinds of things are activated, I guess, in that social context and that the international arena is a social arena. There's something not just political about it. It's social in nature. Is this kind of by extension?
I think that's right. So we can think about international relations dynamics as occurring at multiple levels, obviously. So at one level of analysis, we can look at the relationships between diplomats, between specific policymakers. And you can see this. The president of the United States has a rapport with one individual, does not have a rapport with another individual. George Bush, for example, claimed he had seen into Vladimir Putin's soul. And so those kinds of relationships have an impact on international relations in the broader sense. But we can also think about the collective level, right? And their identities operate in different ways. So we can think about identities at the societal level. So particular political identities might operate in some places differently than they do in other places. And so policymakers, diplomats, the individuals, the agents in the system are operating within relationships that they're establishing with other individuals, but they're also operating within these broader sociopolitical contexts that put constraints on what they can and can't do. Because at least in many democratic states, the policymakers, the politicians, the diplomats are operating within boundaries of legitimacy that are established by the social collective. So for example, if President Barack Obama wanted to make a claim that Canada is an existential threat to the United States, that's unlikely to succeed for a range of reasons, regardless of how Obama sees Stephen Harper, who politically and ideologically is not on the same wavelength as the president. So there's that one level, but then there's a bigger level as well. And so this is part of what makes international relations so messy, right? Because we have all of these different dynamics playing out in different ways at different times. And so we have to be very aware of contingency and how that plays out specific times and places.
That was Jared Hayes, a professor at the Sam Nunn School of International Affairs at Georgia Tech University. We'll get back to our conversation after a short break. I'm Suzette Gerlot, and this is Worldviews. Welcome back to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gerlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Today I'm speaking with Jared Hayes, whose 2013 book, Constructing National Security, examines how different political identities shape U.S. relations with China and India. Before the break, we were discussing how different social dynamics affect the ways states interact in the international arena. So this interaction then might help us understand why some actors in the international arena are threatening and some aren't, even though they have the same capability, for example, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So Iran having a nuclear weapon or Iraq having a nuclear weapon or North Korea having a nuclear weapon is very different to us than Israel having a nuclear weapon, or France, or the UK, or so our friends versus our enemies. So that dynamic of engaging one another on a social level, and whether we're friends or not, has an impact on how we relate to each other about specific capabilities.
Precisely. Yeah.
Well, your work has gone even further into some of the factors that help us identify our friends, and you focus in particular on democracy, mm-hmm. and how democratic form of governance has an impact on our identity, mm-hmm. and our shared understanding, mm-hmm. Of one another, that democracies tend to see each other as we, mm-hmm. and therefore they know what to expect from each other, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. as opposed to non-democracies are in that other category that we don't consider them part of us. It's us versus them in some cases, right? The democracies and non-democracies. We've written an interesting book about how U.S. relates, for example, with China and India. China, a non-democracy. India, a democracy. Tell us a little bit about that relationship and how the United States relates with China differently than with India, because of that common identity as democratic or non-democratic countries.
Sure. So it's actually, I think, very interesting. It might be going too far to say that the United States always views other democracies as friends, because we do, just like in a democratic state, there are a range of relationships. So you can have friends, you can have enemies, but there are boundaries on appropriate patterns of behavior in terms of conflict resolution. So it is inappropriate, illegitimate to use violence in the domestic context to resolve a political conflict. You can sue somebody, you can hate them, but you can't use violence against them. That's beyond the pale. So we can see similar kinds of dynamics play out in the international system. So the United States doesn't always get along with other democracies, and this has actually been the case with India. So the United States has had this very tumultuous relationship with India since its independence. Relations have been good or bad in periodic fashion, in some ways tied to the political ideology of who's sitting in the White House. So relations with India tend to be better when Democrats are in the White House than when Republicans are, although obviously George W. Bush was the exception to that rule. But the United States has never seen India as a threat. And the reason for that is exactly the point that you just made, that it's a sense that India, as a fellow democracy, there are boundaries on the political behavior that can be seen as legitimate. And the key point here is that the use of force is not a legitimate means for resolving a dispute with a fellow Democrat, small d, not big d. So that has shaped U.S. relations with India in very important ways. So situations that might have been seen as threatening if they were carried out, or if they were relations between the United States and a non-democratic state, between the United States and India, have not been seen as threatening. So you make this point about nuclear weapons, which is an excellent one. India has nuclear weapons and has had nuclear weapons since 1974, when they tested what they claim to be a peaceful nuclear device. But the United States has never seen India's nuclear weapons as a threat, at least to the United States. There has been some discussion about India's nuclear program as a challenge to the non-proliferation regime. But in fact, those discussions have never been very strong in the United States either, certainly not nearly as strong as proliferation by other actors. So we can see the ways in which shared sense of democraticness is channeling the U.S. relations with India in particular kinds of ways. And you can also see the lack of shared democratic identity in U.S. relations with China, where American politicians rely very heavily on the non-democratic nature of China to present it as a threat. You can look at situations like the 95-96 Taiwan Straits crisis, or the 2001 incident where an EP-3 U.S. spy plane was grounded on Hainan Island, and see the ways in which American policymakers and public and pundits frame China as a non-democratic state. And what's really interesting in the Chinese case is that those who don't want China to be seen as a threat cannot rely on shared democratic identity to diffuse that argument. So what they instead do is they borrow from potential future Chinese democracy. So this concept of engagement is actually a temporal shift. So the argument is that China will be a democracy in the future if we don't treat them as a threat now. This is the entire premise behind the concept of engagement. And so basically what's happening is they're saying, if we don't treat China as a threat now, they will become a democracy in the future and therefore not a threat. So they're trying to borrow something from the future and move it into today in much the same way that commodities are financialized, and then the value, future value of those commodities is brought into the present. Same idea.
So obviously the United States and China have a strong economic relationship as well. And so those ties perhaps also contributing to, even though they're not a democratic government, they're a somewhat capitalist system. Mm-hmm. So at least they somewhat share a partial identity with the United States. Is that fair to claim in that regard?
It is fair to claim that regard. Economic identity, political economic identity, is different from the kind of political identity that democracy is, because the political identity is fundamentally about how do conflicts of interest get resolved. And the economic identity is different. So for example, in the capitalist economic system, it is perfectly acceptable for entities to disappear. So you're not allowed to use force against other entities, but you can outcompete them to the point that they disappear. And so there is a much more zero-sum nature to capitalism than there is democracy, because in the end, nobody disappears. They may lose office, but they could return to office again, so on and so forth, right? So shared economic identity is there, but it doesn't have the same kind of effect. So this raises a very important point, which is that shared identity by itself doesn't assure any kind of relationship. It's the content of the identity as much as the shared identity itself that matters. So when we look at the content of the identity, then we can see different patterns of behavior arising. So in the case of the United States and China, that shared economic identity is actually stronger than it is with India, because India maintains a much more social democratic orientation. But because this is an economic identity that doesn't provide for non-zero-sum conflict resolution, or doesn't require non-zero-sum conflict resolution, then that relationship is far more unstable than the shared democratic identity with India.
So just very quickly then, this approach you've taken, would this indicate that we should promote democratic governance around the world as a way to improve security relations and promote peace, I guess, if you will, that whole democratic peace argument?
That's a really, really great question, and we can see that the Bush administration and the Obama administration, to a much lesser extent, have tried to do this. But identity is fundamentally something we own, and if it's imposed from the outside, you actually set up identity dynamics that are counterproductive. So we have to facilitate the development of democracy around the world, but we cannot impose it.
All right, Jared. Well, thank you so much for being here today and giving us a lot to think about.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to my conversation with scholar Jared Hayes about the social dynamics of international diplomacy. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can find this and all of our past episodes on the Worldviews page of KGOU.org, where you can also subscribe to our weekly podcast. Worldviews is a collaborative production between KGOU and the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Sam Dupre conducted the research for this interview, writes our digital content, and produced this episode together with Brian Hardzinski. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Berlot.